This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 42 was recorded on December 8th, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. Professor Steve Keen has been one of our all-time most popular guests on the program, and he's back this week as our featured interview guest. We'll discuss his outlook for markets in the wake of Donald Trump's victory, treasury yields, inflation, debt monetization, and a whole lot more.
And I'm Aaron Chen. The stock market has been on fire this past week, trading briefly above the psychologically important 2250 level on the S&P 500. But more and more pundits are coming out calling foul on this rally, suggesting the Trump rally has run out of steam and is set to reverse. So, Eric, what's your take on equities here?
Well, finally, I'm hearing coherent, original views in the financial media for a few weeks there after the election. I think whoever the first guy was to say inflationary aspect of trade policy must be the explanation, everybody just started parroting that same message because they didn't know what else to say. Now we're hearing a lot of different views, and I think there are very coherent and logical views on both sides of this. The people that are saying, hey, what happened here is this was basically a changing of the guard. The people that, you know, most people thought that Trump was unlikely to win. The people that thought Trump was going to be good for the economy and good for markets, they all piled in when he did win, and that propelled the rally as there was a changing of the guard from, you know, a new set of bulls, people with a different ideological viewpoint. But it's done. It's over. It's played out. And indeed, as you said, we hit what looks like it could be a blow-off top, 2251 spot 50 on the S&P futures earlier in Thursday's session, back down to 2244 or so as we're taping this interview at about 3 p.m. New York time. On the other hand, if you look at Trump's policies, whether it be trade policy, infrastructure spending, what have you, those make a bullish argument. I can't decide. I kind of look at it as we need to wait and let the market tell us. I think the people that are saying this could be a blow-off and that it could reverse to the downside make a very persuasive argument, but I'm not ready to go short here because I don't know how much further it has to go, and I think the bulls make a good argument, so I'm on the sidelines. I think in terms of interesting views, though, Pippa Malmgren has an interesting view, which is that she thinks that everybody is assuming that Trump means huge fiscal spend in the sense of deficit spending. She thinks what he's gearing up to do is first threaten China with trade tariffs and then basically sit down and say, look, you guys want to make a deal? Let's make a deal. It's all about foreign direct investment. I want China to pay for building new infrastructure in the United States and get foreign direct investment. Definitely in terms of variant perception, I think she's the only one I've heard with that viewpoint. And definitely a lot of people are assuming that the Trump victory means a lot of deficit spending. Again, I'm on the sidelines. I don't know where this equity market is headed. I'm waiting to see what the market tells us.
When we taped last week's show, the dollar index was flirting with 102. Now, since then, it's traded as low as 99 spot 49. But as we're recording this just after 3 p.m. on Thursday, it was back up at 101 spot 09.
Well, I sure wish that I had bought more at 99.49. I do think that the secular move upward is on. Raul Paul had some interesting views on Real Vision Television about this. They put together kind of a special on the Trump presidency and what it will mean. He made some excellent arguments. I tend to agree with that view. So I think the secular dollar rally is back on. I had been waiting for a pullback, and I missed that move down to the mid-99s. As you say, we're looking at 101 spot 10 around 3 p.m. on Thursday afternoon. If we get back down in the 99s, I'll probably buy some more. But I do think that the trend to the upside is back in play.
Well, we've seen a bit of volatility in crude oil this week, with WTI trading as high as 52 spot 42 and as low as 49 spot 61 since last week's show. What's the story on crude this week?
The first thing that's going on this week is I think the market is trying to digest the OPEC production cut. And frankly, as far as I'm concerned, it's noise because the numbers on this cut are such that everybody can get away with just cheating and producing as much oil as they possibly can. And I think that's what they're probably going to do. And, you know, this thing is in name only. It's for public consumption. But it definitely has an impact on markets and investor psychology. As far as inventory this week, real big dichotomy here. 2.4 million barrel drawdown. Of course, a drawdown would normally be bullish for prices in crude oil inventory. But wait a minute, that's national inventory. Cushing, Oklahoma, which is that critical choke point for the West Texas Intermediate crude oil futures contract, not only a build on inventory, but the biggest one-week build in inventory since 2009 at 3.8 million barrels in a single week. And that's on the back of 2.4 million barrels last week. Now, okay, that's a dichotomy. How come we got a big build in Cushing and a draw nationwide? I don't know. But if we're looking for confirmation, look at finished products. Gasoline, 3.4 million barrel build. Distillates, 2.5 million barrel build. Really huge builds this week on top of really big builds last week. So we're seeing builds in inventory almost across the board, except for the national crude oil inventory number is actually a 2.4 million barrel drawdown. That number's a little bit suspect in my mind, considering nothing else seems to corroborate it. OPEC and non-OPEC are still bickering about whether or not the non-OPEC countries and who's going to participate and so on and so forth. Again, I think it's all noise. A lot of people are saying $60 oil by Christmas. Personally, I'm not buying it. I think at about 52 bucks here, we're kind of played out. We've seen a lot of resistance there. Looks like we're seeing strength this afternoon on Thursday, 50 spot 84 as we're speaking just after 3 p.m. Thursday afternoon. Wouldn't be surprised if we get back up to 52 or so, 52.50, I don't know. But I don't see the move to 60 happening unless there's some new piece of news in order to justify it. What I am watching with much greater interest, though, is that we're starting to see just a hint of backwardation developing in the belly of the term structure. So in other words, at the front of the term structure, the first few delivery months, the price goes up every month. But then after you get about 6 months in, the prices start actually going down month over month as the market is forecasting that there will be a peak in prices, and then it heads back down. So I'm watching very carefully to see what happens with the developing term structure of the crude oil futures market. But for now, I'm not buying this 60 bucks by December story. I think that's a lot of wishful thinking on the part of the bulls.
Gold traded as low as 1158 this past week and was trading around 1172 at 3 p.m. Thursday. Any change to your outlook?
Regular listeners will recall that my thesis that we've discussed for the last several weeks is I think that a rate hike out of next week's FOMC meeting is almost a certainty. That would normally be bearish for gold, but I think it could mark maybe a low point and potentially a buying opportunity. I'm not real certain of that view, though, because the really important indicator for where gold prices are headed is real interest rate expectations. And of course, real interest rates means nominal interest rates minus inflation. Well, in order to have an expectation about real interest rates, you've got to filter out the noise and the hype from two separate variables. That's inflation expectations and nominal rate expectations. And there's plenty of noise and hype in both of those numbers these days. So my point is simply, it's kind of a moving target that's tough to call here. I don't know where it's going. I'm going to be careful. But one thing I can tell you is that if I do buy gold, and I have been looking for signs of a bottoming pattern in the charts, I'll definitely be hedging that position by adding to my dollar index long position. And that, of course, is the pairs trade that Raul Paul and I discussed when he was interviewed on the program several weeks ago. So that's the way that I would approach it, and you know, how much farther it has to go to the downside from here, I really don't know. I'm watching the chart.
And finally, 10-year Treasury yields are still quite elevated, 2.40 as of mid-session Thursday. So, Eric, any change in your outlook here?
You know, I'm really coming around rapidly to the view that Jeff Gundlach has been extremely right on. If he got it right, he called it not just to the day, but I mean to the hour. That guy nailed the trade. And what he said is basically the 35-year secular bull market in bonds ended this past summer. It's over. And that's due to Trump trade policy, Trump infrastructure spend policy, Trump hates Janet Yellen policy. You know, you name it. There's a bunch of catalysts here that are, I think, driving a change. Even Jeff Gundlach himself, though, has said this move that we've seen all the way above 2.40 on the 10-year yield is overdone. He thinks it's going to pull back a little bit before it continues. I'd love to get Raul Paul's view on this. We've, of course, heard from him in a full-length interview before the election. I'd love to know Raul's view post-election. But the guy I really want to talk to about this one is Julian Brigden, because it occurred to me this week when we interviewed Julian, I don't know, it must have been 6 months ago, he called the change from disinflation to inflation before anybody else was even thinking about it. We had people thinking he was nuts when he made that call. And that seems to be playing out. So my rule is whoever got it right before it happened is the guy I want to talk to about what's going to happen next. So hopefully we can get in touch with those two guys.
All right, I'll see what I can do. Professor Steve Keen heads up the economics department at Kingston University in London and has been one of our most popular feature interview guests. Quite a lot has changed since our last interview with Professor Keen, so we're excited to have him back as this week's feature interview guest. Eric's interview with Professor Keen is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next as our featured interview guest is Professor Steve Keen, economics professor at Kingston University in London. Steve, so good to get you back on the program. I really enjoyed seeing you on the other side of the table as the interviewer on Real Vision Television, interviewing Michael Hudson recently, and I definitely recommend that interview to our listeners who are Real Vision subscribers. But where I want to start today is, you know, it's fascinating to me that every single mainstream media pundit and commentator, we're all saying the same thing. If Donald Trump gets elected, equity markets are going to crash. Nobody said anything about the bond market. And of course, what's happened is equity markets went the opposite direction. Bond markets are crashing. And the same exact people that got it completely wrong are now confidently saying, well, this is entirely about inflation expectations that have to do with Trump's trade policy. And I just sort of think these guys have no clue what's going on. I don't put any credence in that just because they're saying it. I'm still trying to figure out what's going on. So what do you make of both the bond and stock market reactions to the Trump election? And what do you think of this mainstream narrative? Is it anywhere close?
Well, the mainstream narrative, as always, is off with the fairies because they leave out the major causal factor in capitalism and then try to analyze it. So don't take their prostrations about the trade impact at all seriously. What I see happening is that people know Trump is going to be a big spending and tax-cutting president. The last person who was like that was Reagan. Reagan used to be called the best Keynesian economist, pro-Keynesian president that America ever had. And Trump's possibly going to put him in the shade. We know he's going to slash the top tax rates and to some extent down the bottom as well. So there goes a large source of government revenue. We know he's going to spend up big as well on infrastructural projects. And I think he'll actually succeed in doing that because he literally knows nobody anything, which is for Donald Trump maybe an unusual position. The Republican Party completely abandoned him. The Democrats tried to cut him off at the knees or maybe even higher up. He confounded expectations and won against everybody. So he doesn't owe anybody any favors of the fact that he's now president. And he can ram through, we know that's going to be his style, the spending he wants, because he wants his name, as we know, plastered everywhere, including now, rather than Trump airplanes and Trump airlines, it'll be Trump airports. So we're going to see a huge fiscal stimulus to the economy. And I think that's what Wall Street was actually reacting to. They thought that what's going to happen if Trump gets leadership? Well, lots of investment projects, lots of construction, lots of government contracts. And so bang up goes the stock market. And on the other side, if you expect that level of spending, there is inflationary expectations built in there because if you have that gigantic increase in government spending, that's going to hopefully generate more employment. And there's plenty of unemployed people to be absorbed despite these fictional low unemployment data we're seeing right now. So with that basis, there's a good reason to expect some inflation and increase in interest rates and therefore a fall in bond rates. I don't think the latter is going to last, by the way, but I can understand why it happened in the immediate aftermath of the election.
Well, if we're going to draw that analogy or parallel to the Reagan election, it seems to me that Reagan, of course, did reduce taxes and spend like crazy, and that had the effects you described, but not until we got through the 81-82 recession, which really began his presidency. And a lot of people would say that we're overdue for recession right now. So do you think there's an argument that maybe before Trump has that heyday of spending and economic boosting, that maybe we're in for a cyclical downturn here?
No, I don't, because the fact that it hit the Reagan administration was also the one that hit Bush number one, and that was that there was a burst in the rate of growth of the credit bubble that's been driving the American economy since 1945. So there was a slowdown in the rate in the rate of growth of private debt after a bit of a bubble before Reagan came into power. That's what caused the slump. Then we've already been through that back in 2008 and 2009, and credit in America is still growing. It won't grow anywhere near as substantially as it did in the past, because with the level of private debt that got accumulated in the subprime bubble, hitting 1.7 times GDP, that's never been reached. That's the highest it's ever reached. We're back down to about 1.5, and it's growing from that level. It won't grow particularly high. But it's currently, debt's expanding at about 7% of GDP per annum right now. There was a bit of it looked like it was actually starting to slow down and go negative again. I think with Trump coming in, it's actually going to go up again. So I think there's going to be a positive boost to the economy from credit, plus Trump's spending programs at the same time. So I've been disappointing quite a few of my democratically aligned friends in New York on this recent trip by saying I think Trump is going to, by his policies, cause an enormous boom and get reelected in a landslide in the second term unless something totally mad happens with the other parts of his administration.
Let's talk about the secular 35-year rally in bonds. And, of course, before the election, Jeff Gundlach was very outspoken in saying, okay, it's over, the bottom is in yields. I thought he was wrong. I thought we were still headed for some sub 1% yields. But, boy, post-Trump election, it seems like maybe the reversal is on in force. What do you think? Is this it for the 35-year-old bond bull market, or would a recession take us to even lower yields?
Oh, it's going to go. I don't think there's any chance for bond prices to keep on falling and yields rising, because again of that level of gearing we've got. Again, I don't know that Trump takes this seriously. I certainly know my economics profession doesn't even look at it. But with the private debt level as high as we've got, you simply can't have high interest rates. What's been driving the interest rates down is the rising level of private debt and the inability for this economy to carry rates anything like what was happening back in the 50s and 60s. And even in the 80s and 90s. So the low yields are here to stay while private debt's still that high. Now, if you have sustained increase in rates, like, now let's imagine we got back to the 4% rate that I know is the fantasy level that the Federal Reserve would like to be operating at. That would 4% plus the margin you put on for commercial rates hitting about, say about 6%, you're talking about close to 9% of America's GDP being necessary simply to service bank debt. Now, that's just unsustainable in the current circumstances. So if it happened for a while, that would eliminate credit growth once more. You'd go from credit being at the moment 7% of GDP back to negative again, and you'd be in a recession. So I think we're going to bounce between the two over time. This is a short-term rally in bonds. I think it'll turn around, but it can be kept alive for a while. On the sheer volume of government spending, and that compensates for the impact of the extra burden of interest rate payments on private debt. So I think we're going to see a bit of a rise, but we're not going to see a return to rates of anything like 4-6%. That's just not on. What happened then?
Well, I've asked that question myself, what could possibly happen if we had historically normal interest rates? It seems to me like it's just impossible to service the the debt burden at that point. And I would assume that that collapses the economy and that we end up with, again, lower yields as a result of that. I want to stay on this topic of private debt, though, because you've been very outspoken in your past interviews on this program that saying basically private debt is the whole problem. We got to do something to get it down. Now, Mr. Trump is not exactly the kind of guy who doesn't believe in debt. So how do you see the Trump presidency, which it sounds like you think is very bullish in terms of growth in other respects? What do you see happening with this private debt problem that you've spoken and written so much about in the past?
Well, that's one thing I find fascinating about Trump, because he's, one thing he's had in his personal history is enormous numbers of debt resets and debt write-offs and so on. So his attitude towards debt is very different to the Republican Party sort of sackcloth and ashes attitude, one must repay one's debts. So if he actually gets to realize that private debt's the problem in the economy as a whole, and that he's got the capability to reverse that by getting the Federal Reserve to do people's quantitative easing and make it into a modern debt jubilee, as I've been arguing for a decade, he might well do it. This is something which I find quite intriguing, because if he did that, the impact of using the government's money creation capability to cancel private debt, as chaotic as the transition would be, would set off a boom potentially equivalent to the 1950s. Now, if he wakes up to that, he's willing to do it, then he could do the debt jubilee that I've been arguing for a decade, and not getting through the brains of neoliberally addled brains of Democrats for the last two terms. So it's an intriguing thought that he could actually do that. I don't know. I mean, I'm going to hold my breath and see whether I get a phone call about, okay, how would we do this? Because if anybody can understand what's involved in doing it, it's somebody who's used accounting to his advantage for his entire business career. So it's one of those weird things that the last person you could expect to do it might actually be the very first person to do it, given his very elastic relationship with private debt himself in his own business career.
You know, it's something as a person who doesn't particularly believe philosophically in debt jubilees, I think your model is by far the most responsible and moral that I've heard yet. Could you state it again, just for our listeners who may not have heard it in your previous interviews here?
Yeah, sure. Well, the bottom line is that we think about debt at a personal level. It's if you lend me your watch and I don't return it, therefore I've ripped you off for a watch which you had to save money to buy in the first place. That's the mental approach most people have to thinking about debt. In fact, debt is just simply created by banks writing an asset on one side and giving you a deposit on the other side of the ledger, which is a liability of theirs. They create it out of thin air. The whole idea that they're constrained in doing it, or that it's something like lending gold, is just the wrong way of thinking about it. Once you've got that straight, it simply says banks can create too much debt, and that can cause a financial crisis if you try to repay it when you've got more debt you can actually handle. That's the background. So what I've argued for is we simply have to get the debt down to enable the economy to grow as it used to in the 50s and 60s, with both the turnover of existing money, which would rise if you reduce the debt burden, and with credit growth as well, if we got back to a level of debt where people weren't worried about extending their leverage. But if you do that just by writing off the debt, then you advantage people who speculated, you penalize people who tried to save their way through their own personal circumstances during the dot-com bubble and the subprime. So what I recommend is to use the government's money creation capacity, so that rather than as quantitative easing as it's currently being done, meaning the government buys the bonds and debts of the private financial sector, it injects money directly into people's personal bank accounts, but requires anybody who's got debt to pay that debt down, whereas people who don't have debt get a cash injection they can spend. And that way you don't benefit debtors over savers, and you actually give a stimulus to the economy rather than crippling it, is what tends to happen when debt is reduced without any other compensating mechanism. So a modern debt jubilee would use the state's capacity to create money, which they're currently using for QE, make it the people's QE, but the money would go to debtors and savers equally and reduce the debt burden on the economy.
You know, Steve, the thing that I really like about this approach that you've proposed is that if you're going to conjure money out of thin air using the government's ability to print it, You give it equally to everyone, and the people that are in debt are forced to use it to pay down the debt, but the other people get to keep the money, and it just sounds so much more fair and equitable. But hang on a second. The U.S. dollar is really the currency of the world, and I presume that what you're proposing is the U.S. government would give all citizens equal amounts of money. So what about the non-citizens? What about the people that have dollar-denominated debt around the world? How would they be affected by what you're proposing?
Well, this would only be something which you could do through American bank accounts. So it would only benefit people in America. I think it's nothing might appeal to one Donald Trump. And, of course, if you did it on a substantial scale, you wouldn't have to do it on a scale of the level that's actually needed to reduce private debt to where the FOIC is where it should be, which is about one-third of what it is right now. But you could do it in small doses. But nonetheless, if you did, of course, that's going to give people extra money to buy imports with. So you would have potentially an increase in the trade deficit, and he's trying to rule that out. So there's an argument in favor of using the government's capacity to control tariff levels to balance it so you keep most of the stimulus domestically rather than letting it leak out internationally. So if he did this, he could also stick with his fairly nationalistic attitudes on trade as well and say, look, we're doing this. Unless you do the same as us elsewhere, we're going to restrict the benefit for America by putting up tariffs so that the stimulus we give to by creating the money stays in the American economy rather than leaking across to you lot who aren't pulling your weight. That sounds pretty much like a Donald Trump-style statement to me.
It sure does. Trump staff are listening to Macro Voices. Who knows? Maybe they'll pick up the idea. Let's move on to the U.S. dollar. We, of course, recently saw the breakout above 97.50 on the dollar index and well above 100 now. Looks like the secular bull market in the U.S. dollar is maybe back on. A couple of people have said they think it might be over, that it's associated with the Trump rally that they thought would fizzle out. What's your view on the U.S. dollar? Do you think it's headed to 110, as some people have said, or is it already overextended here?
No, I think it's likely to keep on going because, again, if Trump gets his stimulus program through, the American economy is going to boom compared to the rest of the world, particularly compared to Europe, of course, which is still locked in the straitjacket of the euro. So in that basis, with an expanding economy, the usual story, people want to put their money where the assets are rising, and you'd get a revaluation of the American dollar continuing. So my expectation is the American dollar is going to continue rising, and that's before we see any probable breakup of the euro on the other side, which again, you take that currency out of circulation, the American dollar has to rise even further.
And the related subject, obviously, is inflation. A lot of people have said, okay, the Trump presidency really means that this is it. This is the moment where we shift from a deflationary trend or disinflationary trend into an inflationary trend on a secular level. Would you agree with that view, and where do you see it headed?
I see it certainly regenerating some inflation, and of course, remember, central banks are trying to cause that right now rather than trying to prevent it, which is what's built into their DNA. But that inflation, to me, can't go the full hog of setting up an inflationary spiral in the economy because we've still got that huge debt burden. We actually need to reduce the debt burden. Inflation is one of the ways to go about it. So I can see some sustained inflation coming out of it because people are wondering why we haven't got inflation right now, and unemployment is, inverted commas, so low. You don't need to go to the Breitbart News to find alternative data to that. You go to exactly the same data source you can find the unemployment data at. This is Federal Reserve's FRED database, Federal Reserve Economic Data. Don't look at check the unemployment data, that's called the U3 series, plot that on one side of your axis, muck around for a while and include another little series which is put together both by the OECD and by the Bureau of Economic Activity and Bureau of Labor Studies. It's called the employment to population ratio. Graph the employment to population ratio for 25 to 54 year olds, and you'll see rather than an obvious recovery, which is what you see when you look at the unemployment data, you see that about 2% or more of that cohort is without a job compared to the number that had a job back in 2007. So there's a substantial slack in the American working age population. It's equivalent to roughly 2 million workers. When you account for demographic change over the last decade, there are about 2 million people who were working of that age cohort, 25 to 54, when they won't be at university, they haven't yet retired, they're not looking to retire. 2 million people in that cohort don't have a job right now, compared to those who had a job in 2007. And it's even worse when you look back to 2000, because that was actually the peak level of employment, the population ratio. You take that into account, there's about 4 million people who would like to have a job, who've fallen off the unemployment data, that little fix in the participation rate, not in the workforce. So the reason that you're getting such a fantastic-looking figure for the unemployment rate is 4 million people have been statistically moved into not in the workforce when they still damn well want a job. And they're the ones who voted Trump. So I think you've got a fairly strong chance you can absorb a pretty substantial increase in the working population of the country without triggering the huge increase in wages that are necessary to give you inflation. So I see it'll be a takeoff inflation to some extent, but it won't be a sustained and rapid boost because the economy is not in a boom right now. The unemployment figures are a lie, and unfortunately the people promulgating that data, the Democrats, the Clintons and even the Krugmans of the world, they don't realize they're lying because they're relying on unreliable data.
Now, there's a theory that I've had for several years, so Professor, maybe you can grade me on my term paper here, so to speak. I've always thought, as we were in a very deflationary backdrop, I've always predicted that, you know, what ends this game? What could happen that would tie central bankers' hands to the point where they couldn't continue to prop up asset markets in the economy by conjuring money out of thin air? And I always thought the answer was, someday we get runaway inflation, and when that happens, it ties their hands because they can't just print money because that would exacerbate the inflation problem. First of all, do I have the theory right? And second of all, it sounds like you think, at least at this stage, we really might have inflation coming, but not the kind of runaway inflation that would be required to trigger the scenario that I described. Am I on the right track?
Well, the central banks can keep on printing money for the asset markets indefinitely. This is one of the dangers. There's no physical barrier to the capacity for the central bank to create money. It's twofold. One, because banks create money out of thin air and they're just another bank in one sense. The second part, however, is that a normal bank, like a private bank, has to have a positive equity. If you have subtracted liabilities from assets, you've got to get a positive sum or you are bankrupt. You get shut down. That's why Lehman collapsed so quickly, and that's why financial crises are such a rapid event. You can go from positive equity to negative in the blink of an eye with an asset revaluation and you're out of business. That never happens to a central bank. They can actually operate notionally with negative equity because effectively their equity is the entire country. So they can keep on doing it forever. Now, the reason QE hasn't given us inflation is because the circumlocuous path which they're trying to make it work is just total nonsense. First of all, they believe that by pumping up reserves, that'll give the private banks more to lend when they cannot lend from reserves. It is impossible, using the rules of accounting, for them to lend their reserves out. It just doesn't work. It's a stupid textbook model that's about time they grew up and threw out. The second side that can work is because they're buying bonds and shares and assets in general off the pension funds and so on. When they buy off the pension funds, they create money in the accounts of pension funds and the like that are then stored with private banks themselves. But those pension funds are mainly required to buy assets with it. So they use that money to buy assets, which drive up asset prices. The money leaks into the real world because, of course, they've got to employ people in those organizations. They're delightful bond traders, the wolves on Wall Street. And when the wolves go shopping, then some of the money they get paid as fees ends up as income in the real economy, and that's where we're getting a small amount of the boost that QE actually generates, but it's absolutely trivial compared to the amount of money they're creating there. So we're not going to get inflation in that route. And the central bank's hands won't be tied by, they won't so much be tied by this ceasing to happen. The inflation actually takes off in the real world because of what Trump does. It won't tie their hands with asset markets, but it'll mean they stop doing it. Now, what that means is potentially a crash in the asset markets because they've pumped up asset markets so much by QE that if they suddenly disappear, that can take away a lot of the buy pressure that's driven up share prices in the first instance. So we could have a bit of a paradox here. We could have an economic boom and a stock market slump.
Steve, I want to move around the globe to Europe because post-Brexit, you know, a lot of people are talking about European exit contagion. Italian referendum, of course, is the most immediate target on the horizon. Austria also. Tell us what's going on there and how do you see it? And what do you think this means for Europe? I'm really getting concerned about the future of the European Union.
Well, I think it's got to fold. The European Union was a great idea, executed badly. And you can't sustain indefinitely a badly executed good idea. So a good idea being preventing French and Germans from blowing each other up. The execution of that meant that France would like to sever its ties with Germany, and most of the rest of Europe would like to blow Germany up, and Germany would like to blow up the rest of Europe, all over the imposition of impossible rules for the euro that have caused a Great Depression in the southern European countries and a boom in Germany because they've got a captive market that can't devalue against them. So it's a horrendous situation overall, and what we're seeing in Italy is Italy suffered all the way through with the change to the euro. It really hasn't grown for going on two decades now. And yet, industrially, nobody's going to claim that Italians can't, for example, make really good cars. The thing is, they're losing out to Germans on selling good cars to their own customers because the lower rate of inflation in Germany has meant that German prices versus Italian, even though the difference in inflation has been quite small, of the order of maybe 1 to 2% per year, you compound that for 15 years and you get a 40 or 50% cost advantage for German exporters selling to Italian customers. So the Italians have got every right to have got sick of the euro and want to break away from it. And that's a large part of what the no vote for this referendum implies. In Austria, similar sort of thing, plus all the racial overtones, the migration impact, the free movement of people, which is part of the euro, was something that was based on the idea of people having episodic reasons to move one country to another. You know, you get a better pay rate, or you tend to prefer the weather in London to the weather in, say, Madrid. But what was actually happening is systemic. You're migrating to get away from a failed state, which is what's happening to the southern European countries that are in the euro. And you go to somewhere which is unfailed, which is either Germany or Austria within the European eurozone, or you go to England. So Brexit's first of all taken that exit route out. If Austrians also object, they're going to move out of the eurozone for the reason just of getting away from free migration. And with Italy, there's a strong sentiment to bring back the lira. Now, of course, on the top of that, you've also got what's happening in France. So with Fillon becoming the centre-right's candidate and the socialists having shot themselves in the foot by swallowing the neoliberal blue pill and imposing austerity on France and believing that would cause an economic recovery, you're going to see a battle between Le Pen and Fillon in the second round. And normally you'd expect the left to come along and try to back Le Pen by voting for the centre-right's candidate. But the centre-right's candidate is just as right-wing on migration, on identity politics and stuff like that as Le Pen is, and promising IMF policies rather than anti-IMF. So France could go. And if France goes to Le Pen, then I think the euro's days are over as of next year.
And if that were to occur, do you see this playing out as sort of a gradual decay where the European Union reverses its trend of growth into a decay period that lasts a couple decades? Or is it something where you get to a point where a couple of key countries are gone and everybody just says, okay, that's it, and everything crashes at that point?
Oh, it'll be catastrophic in the transition. It's going to be smooth at all. If Italy pulls out, probably that's the end of the euro. If France falls out, definitely that's the end of the euro. You're going to have a scramble as countries try to reintroduce national currencies. Some of those countries, hopefully, will sensibly say, we're not going to pay our overseas debts. That's going to totally compromise the French and German banks. They're going to be in desperate need of a rescue. It'll be absolutely hell. It'll make the Lehman Brothers crash look like a picnic. So I expect real chaos in the transition. But of course, if in the process those countries write off their overseas their foreign debts by just refusing to pay them, and also devalue their currencies against the German mark, which is what the euro really is, then there could be a serious recovery in those economies as well. But the financial transition is going to be absolute chaos.
As this all happens, the Eurocrats would like us to believe that, you know, we cannot let the euro fall because peace in Europe, you know, the fact that we don't have wars in Europe as much as we used to is all because of their precious euro. I don't know if that's really true or if that's just the propaganda system for the euro. What do you think the knock-on effects are? Let's say that you're right and that the euro fails. The currency is gone. Europe goes back to national currencies, maybe eliminates the Schengen system, and we're back to borderless Europe has gone away, separate countries. Does that mean that we've got increased geopolitical risk? What are the knock-on effects of this?
I think the geopolitical risk comes out of staying in the euro rather than leaving it, because all you're doing is enhancing the rise of you know, fascist attitudes towards non-nationals. Our very first public fascists in Europe were Greek. Not the usual shade of fascist in that front. So it's just this anti-foreigner sentiment can arise anywhere if you give economic privation, which can be blamed on the foreigner coming in rather than what you're doing domestically. So to me, it's the maintenance of the euro and the maintenance of the European Union as it currently stands is the recipe that's going to lead to this sort of social discord. That's why I was in favour of Brexit. The sooner we get out of the damn thing, the better. But, of course, getting out of it is going to be catastrophic. And you would have things like, you know, the Schengen Agreement might go, free movement might come to an end. It'd be brutal, but it might make people wake up and say, boy, we did that badly. Let's go back and try to do something more sustainable, which respects national boundaries more than we ended up doing in the euro itself. The trouble is, what I know of the euro bureaucrats, they still think they can move towards the idea of a European treasury, where you tax differentially and have fiscal transfers to fix the whole thing up. I just think that's ludicrously optimistic, given they're set up a situation where Germans don't want to pay for Italians and vice versa. When, of course, if you go back to the formation of the European Union, at that stage, the basket case economy, which other economies were helping out voluntarily, was Germany. So we've destroyed all the goodwill that came out of the end of the Second World War, and the desire not to repeat these problems again. So it's just, you know, you're looking at a classic bureaucratic mess. And these things, which if you start something poorly, it'll end badly.
Speaking of classic bureaucratic messes, I'd like to shift gears and kind of move to a personal question, if you don't mind. Something that I heard about recently is apparently there's a move on to categorize or define all of the education over there in terms of sort of a bronze, silver, gold system. And it sounds like the funding for universities is going to be dependent on how some bureaucrat someplace categorize them. I wonder what that means for you, because you obviously are an economist of great international fame, so to speak. You went to Kingston University to take over the department there, and I know that that's a great place to be. But boy, I can't imagine Kingston University is on the gold end of this new spectrum. So what does this mean for you, and how do you feel about what's going on with this socialist classification of education over there?
Oh, it's insane. I mean, the whole idea that you can classify an entire university as gold, silver, or bronze as an educational center on what they call the teaching evaluation framework is just brain-dead stupid. You have brilliant people working in some institutions and useless ones. You have some people who are brilliant academics and lousy teachers. But everybody's going to get a gold standard level at Cambridge, and everybody's going to get a bronze at Kingston courtesy of this classification system. What that means in economics is that the people will believe that that amplifies the belief that you get the best education and everything if you go to one of the prestige universities. Now, all the non-orthodox thought, the sort of stuff that I've developed and the non-mainstream people from Austrians to post-Keynesians have been developing only gets done at the lower-ranked universities because inside economics, the mainstream just drives non-mainstream thought out. So you get Oxford and Cambridge and Harvard and co are just mouthpieces for the mainstream, whereas the divergent voices that have got some originality are in the minor locations. This is going to make it even harder for us to get students than it currently is with that status attitude that students currently have to choosing which university they go to, because all high school students know is high-prestige universities are better than low-prestige. They don't know that low-prestige universities are where innovative thought occurs in economics. So it's another damn handicap, and my response to it is to think I've got to find some other way of reaching the public and reaching students and going through the university sector. This, in some ways, is the final gasp of neoliberal thought being applied to universities, where they believe they can turn it into a marketplace and have no idea of what a market really is. Markets require repeat buying for people to be intelligent about what they're consuming. Otherwise, markets don't work at all well. They're imposing an education where they simply fail to be in the first place, and that paradoxically is making it harder for us to escape from neoliberalism. So it's just the final straw for me to some extent. I think universities have been destroyed by this market-driven ideology that these bureaucrats learnt when they did a couple of years of university economics. And I'm trying to bring in sense, and what's bringing me undone? University economics yet again.
Wow. Well, I know you've got a new book coming out soon. Are you going to do anything else to try to spread your message other than through the university system?
I'm going to say the public can help out here. You need a university structure to get education out at the moment, but that's because you can't get funding unless you're in the university. So I'm going to use the new Patreon site. If you've seen that, patreon.com, which enables people to be patrons of their artists they like. Well, I'm going to have a crack at being an economics artist there and see if I can get enough support from the public to establish a clean online economics resource. I can't call it a university. That would trigger all the copyright rules, but an online resource where we teach people a non-orthodox approach to economics, and we develop it further with the assistance of the public and get away from the fact that universities are no longer a place where you can do paradigm-shifting work. You're only allowed to do stuff which confirms to whatever paradigms might dominate, and that's the exact opposite of my whole approach to economics. So hopefully Patreon will help me spread the word more broadly than the university sector lets me do these days.
Well, I certainly applaud any effort to teach people how the economy really works, because clearly they don't teach it in universities. So is that something that's set up now, or do you have a time frame? When should people be looking for that? Where can they follow you to find out about it? Is Twitter the best place to follow you to know when that's happening?
Yeah, Twitter's the best place to follow. It's when it launches, it'll be patreon.com/ProfSteveKane. That'll be where the page goes. And I hope to be launching it between February and April. It's going to lead up to the launch of the next book, which is April-May.
Okay, and just to refresh us, the next book, of course, is Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? Give our listeners a quick refresher on what that's about.
Yeah, well, it's basically saying once you understand money, credit plays an essential role in a capitalist economy. Credit causes rising debt. You get too much debt, credit no longer can grow, and you end up being stagnation because of excessive private debt. That's what caused the final crash crisis back in 2008. A number of countries evaded the problem by continuing to borrow, countries like China, Canada, Australia, Norway, Belgium, and a few others. And I now expect a financial crisis to occur in them over the next 2 to 3 years as they run out of spending power by getting too much private debt. So we expect a financial crisis in the peripheral countries, of course, including China. And that, when that finally rolls its way through, we're all going to be turned into the what I call the walking dead of debt. And that situation, the only way out is a debt jubilee. I'm not going to hold my breath on it happening, but I suppose in some ways back to where we started, Donald Trump being in power means it might happen in the most unlikely of places with the most unlikely of leaders doing it.
Okay, so the book is, of course, Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis by Professor Steve Keen. That's expected out in April. The Twitter handle is @ProfSteveKeen. And the new coming website to actually teach what they don't teach in university is patreon.com/ProfSteveKeen. Steve, thanks so much for joining us for a fantastic interview. Aaron Chan and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Great interview, Eric. I wanted to start the postgame by talking about Professor Michael Hudson's interview with Professor Steve Keen on Real Vision. It was published just a couple of weeks ago, and I highly recommend it for our listeners who haven't seen it yet. Now, if you're not subscribed to Real Vision, well, then you should. But fret not, you can get a free 7-day trial, and if you use the partner code MacroVoices, that gets you a 10% discount on a full year subscription. Our listeners are obviously very familiar with Professor Keane, but are perhaps not as familiar with Professor Hudson, who is Research Professor of Economics at University of Missouri, Kansas City, and a Research Associate at the Levy Economics Institute of Bard College. He is a former Wall Street analyst and consultant, as well as president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. All right, so Eric, I love how they open up the interview with Professor Hudson explaining the crux of his latest book, Killing the Host, which is that the financial sector is very much like a parasite that has successfully convinced the host that it is an integral part of the host's body. Now, you talked about the crazy equity rally we've seen since the election. If you look at the Dow, a substantial portion of those gains are driven by banks. Just look at Goldman. It's up 30%. JP Morgan, up 20%. Are the parasites trying to convince us that they're good for the economy? Or, I mean, what do you think is behind this rip higher in bank stocks?
Well, first of all, I am a huge fan of Michael Hudson. I can't wait to read the book, and I love the title and the kind of play on words that he's using there. I think it's an excellent analogy. We ought to get him on our wish list to get on the program because I've always been a fan of his. As far as what's driving the bank stocks, probably it looks, I think a lot of people are persuaded that we're looking at a secular change in the direction of yields here. And of course, higher yields give banks more room, you know, to make more money. So I think that that's probably the explanation of the bank stocks. As far as the rest of equity markets, you know, again, as we discussed earlier in the program, I really could see this going either way. I think that the two schools of thought here that are forming is one just says, look, this is a changing of the guard rally where a bunch of new longs came in because they like Trump. That's been played out. Equity valuations are just way overextended here. The other side of the argument is Trump is going to spend on infrastructure, and the trade policies could be inflationary. Some people actually think that higher interest rates are inflationary because they increase the cost of money. I'm not sure if I completely buy that argument, but it's an interesting one. So there's a couple of schools of thought, and I'm on the sidelines waiting to see what plays out. I definitely think that equity valuations are very stretched here, but hey, I've been saying that for 2 years, so I'm happy to get out of the way of this. I certainly don't want to be short, and I'm waiting to see what happens.
All right, I want to stay on this topic of the banking system because, you know, you and I both know that the problems stemming from 2008-2009 have only been papered over. And Monte dei Paschi of Italy is just the latest episode, now stalling to get a bailout after failing to execute on a private recapitalization. Sure, central banks around the world can keep suppressing volatility with their asset purchases and by selling VIX futures, but the unresolved issues are starting to rear their ugly heads, but this time it's being met with rising populism around the world. So does this mean bankers will go to greater lengths to keep the game going with draconian financial repression, or are they starting to lose control here?
I think it's totally uncharted territory, and a place where my view has changed, and you heard it in this interview with Steve Keane, is I used to say, look, okay, we're coming up to an end game, folks. What's going to happen here is central bankers are going to lose control of the curve. And as soon as interest rates start to back up, what happens is the government cannot afford to pay its bills. It's the cost of debt service is too expensive. The government cannot continue to operate. And as there's a loss of faith in the government's ability to pay its bills and operate, that causes a loss of faith in treasuries as being a safe haven asset. People fall out of treasuries, and it's a self-reinforcing vicious cycle. Professor Keane has a view that even in an inflationary environment, they still have plenty of room to keep on printing money. This has never happened before in modern financial history. We don't know what happens when all the central banks around the world are printing money like crazy. So far, all of the people, myself included, that said eventually they lose control of the curve and we get a massive spike in yields that cripples the government and a treasury market crash, that's still entirely possible, plausible. But I've definitely come around to appreciate the other view, which is they can arrest this pretty easily with more money printing. So I don't know what's going to happen here. Certainly, we're seeing the beginning of a secular move in bond yields. I'm also watching what some of the spreads are doing in terms of junk versus treasuries, and I don't really have a clear picture. Julian Brigden is the guy that I would really love to talk to about this subject, because if anybody, if I think through all of our Macro Voices interviews over the last year, you know, who's the guy that really called what's happening here with a reversal in bond yields and a reversal potentially appears to be upon us from a deflationary or disinflationary trend towards an inflationary trend? Brigden is the guy who called it before anybody else, so I would really love to talk to him about this.
All right. Lastly, why don't you provide our listeners with an update on where we stand in terms of hiring a new producer and co-host for Macro Voices?
Well, I heard from quite a few people. I am, as soon as we get this show produced today, I've got a reply to everybody. I apologize, I was traveling. A couple things I want to set straight. This can be done from anywhere. I had several people say, you probably wouldn't consider me because I'm not in New York City. Don't need to be in New York City, doesn't really matter where you are. And I am most interested, really, in trying to figure out how to either find a sponsor or otherwise cut some production costs so I don't have to keep paying for this thing out of pocket. I've got a couple of companies that might be, you know, tasteful sponsors for the program. And I've got several people that have written me about the producer co-host role. So I'm going to try to get back to them. I welcome more inquiries. Right now, we're still looking. If anybody doesn't know what we're talking about, Aaron is leaving the program because of a fantastic career opportunity that he's come into. And in last week's show, after the feature interview with Art Berman, we went into much more detail about exactly what Aaron's job entails and why we're looking for someone to replace him. So please refer back to that if you're just coming up to speed on this for the first time.
Great. Thanks for that update, Eric. Anything else to add before we finish?
You know the story, folks. We really need your help promoting the show. We're getting some fantastic guests on the program. If you retweet us every time you see that announcement on Twitter of the show coming out, tell your friends, forward your research roundups, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com, especially you accredited investors, because that's the statistic, how many registered users we have and how many of them are accredited investors. That's what we use to sell the really high-profile guests, the hedge fund managers, the people we really want to get on the program, on why this is worth their time. So register your free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you get the free research roundup email, which is a compendium of links to all of the coolest research that Aaron could find on the internet this week. So what do we got for him this week?
We've got an excellent lineup for you this week, starting with the latest investment outlook from Bill Gross and an excellent market update from Alex Gurevich. You'll also want to check out Raoul Powell's post on the horrid year it's been for fake news organizations, and makes the case that nonconformist views need to be considered even more seriously than ever before. Finally, Jayant Bhandari has written an excellent five-part series on the sudden demonetization of 500 and 1,000 rupee notes in India. You'll find all this and much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we've gotten and continue to welcome your suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For our listeners who write or blog about global markets and would like to share that content with our pro-finance community, shoot us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag and we'll include it in our weekly distribution. If you haven't already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for the latest updates and interview releases. You can also follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Macrodidact. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chan. Chat with you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.